Welcome to the first Sound Off of 2010. This is episode 95. Episode 100, episode 108, 115, 122, 127, 133, 139. Can't stand the impact zone. They gotta get the fuck out of that building as quickly as possible. Get over yourself.
Get over yourself.
If Shane Helms wants to go off on somebody for being a drug user, I mean, that's in a way like, you know, the pot calling the kettle black here. If you really want to open up that can of worms, let's do that.
I don't necessarily love the fact that he came out dressed as a long-lost member of the Village People, but, you know, to each their own. I mean, in all honesty, if you ran into Big Dave in a dark alley and he was wearing what he was wearing on Monday night, would you really say something to him? I don't think so.
You can resurrect some of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Andre the Giant can rise from the grave. It would not mean a damn thing. The new owner of ECW, Stephanie McMahon. Angle, in the garbage. Done. Finished. I am not a fan of this angle. This is stupid. This is just stupid, unrealistic bullshit that we've seen so many times before. Who the fuck comes up with these names on NXT? Can you picture Husky Harris wrestling in the main event of WrestleMania? Percy Watson? Eli Cottonwood? And I gotta tell you something, there's no way that Paul Heyman watches that show on Thursday night and thinks, man, I gotta be a part of that. Abyss.
Abyss.
Why? Why?
Why?
I don't know.
Too bad you weren't near me. I'd eat your brains right now.
You're not that far away from me. I'm in Brooklyn, you're in Staten Island, so.
Maybe tickle your balls with a feather.
Due to a combination of steroids and pain pills, I have officially become a professional wrestler. What a year it was for the Sound Off 2010 in the books. A damn fine year, if I do say so myself, and looking forward to a lot more of that in 2011. This, by the way, is the New Year's 2011 edition of the Sound Off here on SEScoops.com, episode 140. As always, I am the Solo Monster, because if it's not the Solo Monster, it's not the Sound Off. So there you go. Again, thank you everybody for downloading the podcast. We've had a lot more people listening of late who seemingly like what they hear, and hopefully they'll keep coming back in the new year. Hope everybody, by the time you've listened to this, had a fun and hopefully safe New Year celebration, or not. If you just want to stay at home, that's fine too. But hopefully all is well. And I look forward to a lot more good stuff here in the new year. What we're going to do this week, a little bit later on, the best of 2010 WWE Top 10 Countdown. I said last week that we're going to look at the positives of 2010, and I put together a list of 10 things. It could be an angle, it could be a match, it could be a superstar, whatever it may be. 10 of the best things that we saw, heard, experienced, or what have you in WWE in 2010, and I'm sure we'll talk about some bad stuff too, but that'll come up a little bit later on. A lot of news going on, breaking this week, and then got some Raw thoughts as well. So a packed show here for the first episode of 2011. The first thing I have to say here, just to kind of get this out of the way, for all the emails I get about the anonymous Raw general manager, people asking me who it is or when this angle is going to be over with, I don't have any answers to any of those questions, but I will say this. The one person who I certainly hope is not revealed to be the anonymous Raw general manager when all is said and done is Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City. Holy God. Let me tell you. Now, for those of you who live in New York, or at least the tri-state area, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. More specifically, if you live in any of the outer boroughs of New York City, not named Manhattan. I am here in Brooklyn, and I must tell you that we received a great deal of snow earlier in the week. Actually, it was at the very end of last weekend into Monday. And it's not like we've never seen snow here before. And I'm sure there's people listening to this right now who live in Alaska, maybe Minnesota, places where huge amounts of snowfall to them is commonplace. And they're thinking, gosh, what a pussy you must be. But whatever the case may be as far as whether it was mishandled or if supposedly there was some sort of intentional movement by people who were dissatisfied with the mayor to not do their jobs. Whatever happened, the way that this cleanup effort was handled was piss poor, to the point where for the first time in my life, I actually had to miss consecutive days of work simply because I couldn't get to the office. That's how bad it was. Entire bus lines and subway lines were shut down. I mean, you would think New York City, of all the places in the world, would be able to handle a situation like this. And it literally was like something out of a disaster movie. I mean, you would look around and think a bomb landed on this place. And we're still digging out from it. It really is horrible what's been going on here. And again, some places got plowed out and cleaned out right away. And some places you couldn't drive down the street 3 or 4 days later. So it's been a pretty shitty situation around here. Hopefully we'll get a break and won't have any more of this snowy crap. I know some people love snow. I love snow too, except when I actually have to navigate through it. Then it's not so fun. So that made for an interesting week for the Solid Monster. I actually thought about recording this episode earlier in the week, being that I had some unexpected free time on my hands. I'm actually happy I didn't, because correctly I figured perhaps news will break during the week, and I don't want this episode to feel outdated by the time it gets posted online. And sure enough, on Tuesday night at a WWE house show in Wilkes-Barre, however you want to pronounce it, Pennsylvania, John Cena suffered an injury in a steel cage match against Wade Barrett. Yes, the same Wade Barrett who we were led to believe was apparently slaughtered by a bunch of steel chairs at the TLC pay-per-view. He is indeed alive and well. So, apparently Cena injured his hip during the steel cage match. There was a lot of fear at first that it was a very serious injury. Perhaps it was a knee injury that would require a significant time off. He might miss WrestleMania. People were panicking. As it turned out, it looks like it was all for naught. Cena suffered an injury that isn't considered all that serious. He probably won't wrestle this week on Raw. He may not wrestle for a couple of weeks, but it doesn't look like something that's going to keep him out for any significant period of time, which is good for CM Punk and his Nexus brethren, because of this new angle that we saw pushed forward on Raw this past Monday night, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Apparently the injury is believed to be a bruised hip. Like I said, not expected out for any length of time. A day-to-day injury. If he was a baseball player, he would be on the DL day-to-day. So that's good news if you're WWE, because believe me, they're already facing a situation where there's a fairly decent chance The Undertaker may not be able to make WrestleMania. And just the thought of The Undertaker and John Cena not being able to make it to WrestleMania is enough to make Vince McMahon probably throw $5 million at the first person that would take his money. I'm sure people like a Bill Goldberg or people like that would love that sort of offer from WWE. And as it is, they're kind of panicking because they're looking for that big name or that big idea for WrestleMania. So anyway, the point is, Cena being seemingly okay is good news for WWE, and it's good news for us too, because let's be honest here. Even if John Cena were to go down with an injury, they'd probably just slot Randy Orton in his place. And to me, they're almost interchangeable at this point. I mean, you either go with your top guy, or you really do take a risk and give an opportunity, to a younger guy, whether it's a John Morrison or a Daniel Bryan or whoever it may be. And they're just not going to do that. I answered this question in the latest SC Scoops mailbag. Somebody asked the question, what if John Cena was to suffer a career-ending injury? Which, again, I said in the mailbag was ironic, because I got that question a full 5 days before Cena actually did get hurt, and people were fearing the worst. And the reality is that it's not WWE style to take somebody, whether a mid-carder, somebody who is unproven in their eyes, and put them into the top angle in the company or the top storyline in the company. Like I said, if Cena goes down, you're more likely to see Randy Orton or Triple H make an early comeback. And instead of a program with Sheamus, he gets slotted in with CM Punk, and we all know how that's going to turn out. So good news on the John Cena front. Lots of news reports this week that Awesome Kong has signed a contract with World Wrestling Entertainment. There's been no confirmation from Kong or WWE. I wouldn't expect there to be, especially if they want to keep her debut possibly a secret. I have no idea what they might have planned for her. I'm still somewhat skeptical that there's even a deal in place, but again, that seems to be the big story, that she has signed a contract. If she has, I think it's a great move. It's a little confusing to me. Kong has been out of TNA now for quite some time. If I were WWE, and I'm pretty sure her name was on the list of people I would have recruited from the independents or other wrestling organizations when I did my WWE kind of business model show, which was episode 127. Go back and listen to that if you have not heard it. Kong is great because she's so much different than what you're used to seeing in a WWE diva. And different is better. Different makes you stand out more. Quite frankly, it's not a problem relegated to the divas either. I mean, a lot of guys in WWE, from the way they dress to their haircut to the way they cut a promo, the way they wrestle, it's very homogenized now. It's very cookie cutter. So somebody like Kong stands out. Quite frankly, you could put her in the divas division, have her fight for the title. You can have her mix it up with the guys. I'm not saying the second coming of China, but if you wanted to have Kong come in, let's say it's someone's bodyguard, that someone doesn't necessarily have to be a diva. You know, she could be a bodyguard. She could take Jackson Andrews' spot and be a bodyguard for Tyson Kidd. After what happened on Monday night on Raw, I have no idea what's going on with Jackson Andrews. But the point is, this would be a great signing for them. What makes it confusing to me is she, about a week or two ago, it was very recent, that Kong was in the news. Actually, might have even been within the last week, for being pulled over and cited for driving a vehicle with either, I believe it was a suspended license or no license. Not the biggest infraction. You know, maybe it was an oversight. It's not like she got pulled over driving, you know, punch drunk. But WWE, I know, is very leery of signing people who have had issues in the past. And we know Kong's issues in the past with Bubba the Love Sponge. And even though Bubba the Love Sponge is a fat piece of shit, sorry, but he is, you know, Kong still didn't have any right necessarily to attack him in TNA the way that she did. Again, that was one of the reasons that she ended up leaving the company. You can't just go around attacking people because they're an idiot. I mean, if I went around attacking people because they were an idiot, my whole day would be filled with attacking people. And, you know, I tend to be a nonviolent person. So, you know, being that she was in the news again for something else, it's just a little odd to me that now is the time, of all times, that she would sign with WWE. But if she did, good for her. I think it's a great signing, and we'll see what they do with her. I mean, again, you can go a million different ways. You can build her up, you know, as coming into the Divas division, have her come in and crush everybody in her path, challenge for the championship, win the championship, and she could be the big monster that all the babyface women try to conquer. You can bring her in and have her be somebody's bodyguard. You know, as long as they don't bring her in and just do comedy with her. I mean, that is their trademark, is let's do comedy with them. Let's bring in Awesome Kong and put her in there with Santino Marella. Because if that's what they're going to do with her, then it's a fucking waste. So I really hope that if they sign this woman, they've got something real good planned for her, because she could be a difference maker. I'm not saying she's going to be a Steve Austin. I don't mean a difference maker like that. But she could make a difference in the ratings, which are so important to them. She could be a pay-per-view draw, a ticket draw. It all depends on how she gets booked. And plus, let's be honest here, she can be a little bit of a wild card. She could be a crazy person. So hopefully she keeps her shit together as well. We actually just saw Kong wrestle on the Ring of Honor I pay-per-view, the final battle show that I talked about on one of the recent sound-offs. She competed on there, and I believe she actually won. She was in a tag team match. So, yeah, good for Kong if she did sign with WWE. She had made a comment on her Twitter saying that, quote, "My dreams just came true today. I got my dream job." Yes, that one. Again, very cryptic. We don't know if she meant WWE, but if she did, congratulations. Everybody should get to live their dream at least once. Jeff Hardy apparently is going to plead guilty to most, if not all, of the drug charges pending against him in his never-ending drug case. Apparently, he's going to be back in court, I believe, on January 20th. And again, there's been no confirmation of this, but all stories seem to indicate that he will plead guilty in exchange for some sort of plea bargain. My guess is that he doesn't serve any jail time, which just blows my mind. If you look at the list of charges against this guy, which I actually read on this show a couple of weeks ago, if this were anybody else, they would have been locked up a year ago, and they would have thrown away the key. You know, Jeff Hardy, Matt Hardy, they've claimed that, well, Jeff Hardy really hasn't said anything, but Matt Hardy and other friends of Jeff have been public in saying that it was a setup, things aren't as they seem, you know, he'll have his day in court. Look, maybe he is truly not guilty of these charges. Maybe the shit didn't belong to him. Maybe he was set up. I find it a little hard to believe. They did find all of this stuff in his home. Apparently, by wrestler standards, a lot of wrestlers, when they heard the amount of each drug or steroid or whatever that was found, a lot of wrestlers, or I guess people in the business, their first reaction was, oh, that's it? Which is kind of fun. Actually, it's kind of sad. But still, he got found with a lot of different things, a lot of prescription medication that he may not have had prescriptions for. I know they found cocaine residue, and they found anabolic steroids. The most serious charges against him were the trafficking charges. Perhaps it was a situation where the government couldn't prove that Jeff was either going to or had been trafficking this stuff. I don't believe he was, personally. It's not hard for me to believe that Jeff Hardy, who's had drug issues before, would have this shit laying around in his home. Do I think he was a drug dealer? I don't think so. But again, we haven't heard much. Nobody's really been saying anything. All these continuances, month after month after month, they keep pushing it back and pushing it back. We don't know if that's the defense or if it's the prosecution. And I've had people write into me, people who have been in situations like this before, have sent me feedback, shedding a little more light on how this works. And they said it makes a big difference, because if it's the defense that keeps getting this pushback, that's probably a bad sign for them. And if it's the prosecution that keeps pushing things back, it probably means they're going to have a tough time proving their case. So again, it looks like there's some sort of plea. My guess would be he doesn't serve jail time. Perhaps he'll serve 6 months to a year, which is probably better than the 20-plus years he may have otherwise served. Either way, it's going to be interesting to see how TNA reacts to this. Because if Jeff Hardy goes to jail for any length of time, and I don't think he will, but if he does, obviously you have to take the title off him. I mean, that's just it. Now, I know this is TNA, and TNA could very easily keep the belt on him and have him do satellite promos once a month from his prison cell. But I'd like to think that even TNA would have enough sense to take the belt off him as soon as possible. Now, if he pleads, and as part of the plea, he does not go to jail and he avoids jail time, if I'm TNA, I still take the title off him. Because by pleading guilty to these charges, you now have a world heavyweight champion in the news pleading guilty to very serious drug charges. And it's not as though we don't know Jeff Hardy's had a checkered past. You know, he's not exactly a model. He hasn't been a model employee all the time. But I don't see from a PR perspective how you can keep the title on Jeff Hardy at a time when he was just convicted on drug charges and pleaded guilty to drug charges. So what do you do? Like I said, if I'm TNA, either way, I get the belt off of him. Put it on Rob Van Dam. You know, technically, you've got it in storyline. RVD never did lose the championship. You know, and he may not be as over as Jeff Hardy, but Jeff Hardy's lost a lot of luster since he turned heel. People just don't seem to be as into him. That was a big mistake on TNA's part. You want to give Matt Morgan a chance to run with the belt? You know, like I said, you know, Morgan impresses me on some of his promo work. In the ring, he's not much. Just a big dude. You know, somebody like Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe wouldn't be the worst choice in the world. Lord knows they haven't been doing anything with him. He just re-signed with the company. So he's given them a commitment for another 2 to 3 years. Be interesting to see what happens. Jeff is not scheduled to defend the title at the next pay-per-view. He's scheduled to defend it in February against the winner of the Mr. Anderson-Matt Morgan match at the January pay-per-view. So, you know, they've got the pay-per-view coming up, and then they have, another batch of TV tapings that come before the next hearing. So if they're going to make a move, they'd have to make a move within the next couple of weeks, whatever they're going to do. You know, beyond that, I've said my piece on Jeff Hardy in the past. I've commented, on the entire what I call Carolina cocaine crew. They're a bunch of kooky guys, but as far as Jeff Hardy is concerned, you know, here's a guy that's been given chance after chance after chance. You know, I didn't think WWE, quite frankly, was going to give him another chance the last time. And the last time they gave him a chance and re-signed him happened to be when he caught fire. He actually caught fire during that feud with Umaga. And it was that propelled him, essentially, into being a main eventer. After all the other times he was with the company and he quit or he got fired or whatever the case, it was that last time when I thought he was already all out of chances. that he caught fire, became a big star, became a world champion. Everything seemed to be firing on all cylinders for the guy. And, you know, to see him now compared to where he was even just, you know, 2 years ago, year and a half ago, it's a shame. But the guy has a kid now. So at the end of the day, his wrestling career and his Divas Championship belt that he carries around and all that stuff, it don't mean shit. The guy has a child now. And at the end of the day, you got to have your priorities in order. Whatever the outcome of this is, I hope for the best for the guy. I hope he gets his act together. If he goes to jail, hopefully, you know, he'll do his time. He'll find God or whatever the hell, you know. It's been so many wrestlers that, you know, become born again over the years. I guess it's just the business, I guess. I don't know. But hopefully things turn out well for him. And as far as his brother is concerned, hopefully his New Year's resolution is that he'll start eating Subway instead of White Castle. Let's talk about Raw from Monday night. The big story, obviously, CM Punk is the new leader of Nexus. Nexus is, in fact, back. They had David Otunga as their spokesperson, which is a frightening thought, talking to John Cena on Monday night. Let's go back to the beginning of the show here. Show started off with a back-and-forth promo. It was actually a John Cena promo that morphed into a back-and-forth promo with him and CM Punk. And I got to tell you, John Cena is a great promo guy when he wants to be. But I made the comment on one of the old sound-offs, and some people emailed me and said, oh, you're crazy. But they didn't really pay attention to what I was saying when I said it. I said at the time that John Cena may be the worst promo guy in WWE. And that promo that he cut on Monday night is proof positive that I was right when I said that. The John Cena we saw at the beginning of Raw Monday night cutting that promo was not the same John Cena that we saw the night after Survivor Series, cutting that passionate promo about how he was going to go home and spend more time with his family, and he was getting all teary-eyed. Of course, he ended up lying to us anyway. He never did truly go away, which I guess means that his family don't mean shit to him because he never did go home. Maybe he went home for a day and he had to be right back at Raw the next week. The point is, John Cena was so hokey and smarmy and cracking jokes like this was some sort of stand-up comedy act, he almost single-handedly killed the entire angle. The entire segment was practically ruined by John Cena. You could not possibly take a fucking word he said seriously at the beginning of that promo on Monday night. I don't see how anybody in their right mind could have taken a single syllable seriously. And this is supposed to be one of your main storylines. You know, CM Punk has been attacking John Cena with a steel chair now. Last week on two different shows, we have no idea why he's decided to attack John Cena. You would think if John Cena came out there and actually gave a shit, he'd be pretty upset at the fact that CM Punk has now showed him up twice, beating him up with a steel chair twice for no apparent reason. But no, he comes out, he's smiling, he's happy, and again, cracking jokes that quite frankly aren't funny, which brings me to CM Punk. I was happy that Punk came out, and one of the first things he said was, John Cena, you're not funny, which I thought was the biggest shoot comment maybe on Raw all year long. None of what Cena said was funny. And he can be funny from time to time. This was not funny. This was irritating. This actually pissed me off. CM Punk saved it, but barely. Because Punk was the only one out there who actually was taking it seriously. And, you know, I understand that John Cena is given scripted material like everybody else is, but it just boggles my mind. John Cena has been in this company now for 8 years, over 8 years. He is the face, for all intents and purposes, you know, he is the face of World Wrestling Entertainment. He is their top guy. He's been their top guy. He's main evented WrestleManias. He's held 10 or more world championships. He is, to this era, to this generation, like it or not, what Stone Cold was to the Attitude Era, what Hulk Hogan was to the Rock and Wrestling Era. That's what John Cena is to the PG Era. If John Cena wanted to, he could change the material, or at least not make it as hokey. Make it a little more believable. You know, even if you're handed a pile of bullshit, work with it. Do what you can to craft it, mold it, and make it better. I mean, I know things are different now than they were 10 or 12 years ago. You know, you hear stories of Steve Austin would be handed something by Vince Russo or one of the writers, and he would just say, fuck it. He would roll it up into a ball, chuck it in the trash can and go out there and say whatever the hell he wanted to say. You know, The Rock would actually laugh off some of the writers when he was given stupid bullshit. He would laugh. He would actually laugh in their face. And that's not because he was a prick. It was because he was right. Because he knew that what he was given to say was unrealistic, it was stupid, and it just wouldn't have worked. But that's why those guys were so successful. Now, John Cena has enough clout, one would think, where, you know, if he got material handed to him by a writer, it's not like Vince McMahon is actually the one writing the stupid bullshit for him. He would have enough common sense to look at it, even if he doesn't want to offend the person, and go, you know what, this is great, but how about if we do it this way? Or how about if we do it that way? You know what, maybe he does. I'm not in the back when he gets handed this stuff. Maybe he is, and he gets turned down. I just find that impossible to believe. I think if John wanted to speak up and put his own spin on it, or just say, fuck it, I'm not going to say this stupid crap, I'm going to do it my way, give me two bullet points, tell me what I need to say, and I'll do it on my own. If he wanted to do it, he could do it. I mean, does he not realize how just idiotic it sounds when the stupid stuff comes out of his mouth? I mean, come on, man. Grow a set of balls. Speak up. Do it for us. Do it for the kids. Oh, who am I kidding? The kids eat this shit up. Now, what I found interesting about this is when Cena came back out later in the show, this was when he came out and he kept repeating, CM sucks, CM sucks. He was a hell of a lot more serious than he was early in the night. In fact, it was a complete 180 from the John Cena we saw at the beginning of the show. And it wasn't like in the middle of Raw something else happened, like Cena got attacked or embarrassed, so he was pissed off all of a sudden. Nothing happened. I mean, the only thing we really saw during the show, maybe I'm forgetting something, but we saw a bunch of segments where CM Punk confronted Sheamus, and CM Punk was talking to a bunch of EMTs, telling them, you know, you better be ready for what I do to John Cena later. But nothing really happened to John Cena. So when he came back out, and he was so much more serious, and he looked angry. You know, the funny ha-ha John Cena that we saw at the beginning of the show was gone. It was a completely different person. So why he couldn't do that at the beginning of the show, I don't know. Why he came out at the beginning so happy and all of a sudden at the end he was pissed off, maybe somebody said something to him backstage. Maybe they said, listen, cut that part out of the act. I want you to go out there and be serious now. You know, but if that's the case, why didn't you do that at the beginning of the show, genius? Doesn't make sense. So, yeah, it was a different Cena when he came out later on in the show. I don't know if anybody else noticed that. Some other notes that I made here, just the important, I guess, parts of the show. Ted DiBiase. Boy, oh boy. Here's a guy that, a year ago, there were people saying that this guy's going to main event WrestleMania within 2 or 3 years. He was the one that was supposed to be the shining star when Legacy broke up earlier this year. Remember Legacy? Have we not forgotten the debacle that was the breakup of Legacy? That might have been the biggest botch of 2010, now that I think about it. Even more so than this Nexus angle. I mean, DiBiase, talk about a rising star whose stock has just plummeted to the depths of hell. I mean, obviously they're doing a losing streak angle with him. And, you know, that in and of itself, I question that, but they obviously are doing a storyline where he seemingly is losing every fucking match. At one point, I thought him and Maurice were breaking up. There was no sign, I think, of animosity between them on Monday, so I don't know if they're breaking up, if this is, if they're trying to make this a shoot storyline, like real-life breakups, which don't always go so smoothly and sometimes get carried out a lot longer than they should be. I don't know. I question DiBiase's sexuality in that he's been paired off with Maurice, and ever since he was paired off with Maurice, he seems angrier. He seems like his life has been in the dumps since he got paired off with Maurice. I don't know about you, but if I got paired off with Maurice, life would be like a fucking flower every single day. I mean, maybe she spent all of his money. You know, maybe that's why he's upset. I don't know. The point is, he lost cleanly to Santino Marella on Monday night, which just has to be the bottom of the barrel. I mean, even when Sheamus lost to Santino, you can make the argument that John Morrison came out and interfered or distracted him. There was nothing like that. He just lost to Santino. That was it. I think it was like a roll-up. And that was the end of the match. So, I don't know what they're doing with him. Cody Rhodes is over more than DiBiase is. And Cody Rhodes ain't that over with that ridiculous gimmick he's got on SmackDown. So, really, you can say both guys, you know, as far as the whole legacy thing, being that we're kind of reflecting back on the year that was 2010, when we think back to legacy and really what the intended purpose of that was, it wasn't all that different from the purpose of Evolution. You know, when they put Evolution together, Randy Orton and Dave Bautista were handpicked by Triple H to be the next big thing in WWE. And Triple H didn't pluck them out figuring that they were going to end up like DiBiase and Cody Rhodes are. He saw potential in them. Maybe he wanted to ride their coattails a little bit too, make himself more relevant. Wouldn't shock me. But the point is, Bautista went on to be a big star. Main event WrestleMania, multiple-time world champion, and Randy Orton obviously has gone on to be arguably an even bigger star. I mean, he's still with the company. He's still growing. His you know, his star will continue to rise for many more years to come as long as he can stay healthy and strike free with the wellness program. So that was kind of the idea behind Legacy. Let's have Randy Orton, who benefited from Evolution, give some rub to these two guys who we see something in. You know, they're both second generation or third generation guys. You know, like I said, DiBiase was the guy they thought would be main eventing WrestleMania within a couple of years. The problem with DiBiase is he has no charisma. He is completely devoid of charisma. I mean, if you have a wrestler manufacturing line, okay, here's the conveyor belt, and wrestlers are just pumped through, and at some point you end up in this machine that gives you charisma, then what must have happened, my guess, with DiBiase is there was a malfunction at the junction, as they say. And he got skipped over because he has none of it. I mean, zero. Compared to his father, you would think he was switched at birth. And that's what's holding him back. It's not just that WWE doesn't know what the fuck to do with the guy. He bears some responsibility here, too. Because he looks like everybody else, he sounds like everybody else, and he just doesn't seem to give a shit. So, I don't know what's going on with him, but it ain't good. And speaking of not good, that brings me to Tyson Kidd and Jackson Andrews. Holy shit. You talk about killing somebody dead. I mean, it's not like I expected Tyson Kidd to last very long. I knew he was doomed. But I figured Jackson Andrews was the guy that they were really grooming to be a star, not Tyson Kidd. But then Jackson Andrews gets in the ring after Mark Henry beats Tyson Kidd clean. And we have a face-off between Mark Henry, who, while Mark Henry could crush me in an instant if he wanted to, the fact is, as he's been booked on TV now for many, many months, he's been booked to be a jobber, quite frankly. I mean, Mark Henry even jobbed clean to Cody Rhodes on Raw not all that long ago. Yet, here's Mark Henry face-to-face, well, not exactly face-to-face, since Jackson Andrews is just, he towers over him, but, you know, confronted by Jackson Andrews in the ring, and what happens, you know, I thought, obviously, Jackson Andrews now is going to beat the shit out of Mark Henry, and it's going to be all about him. It's not about Tyson Kidd, but no. He gets the world's strongest slam, he's left for dead, and they move on to the next segment. So, I don't know if they've just given up on the guy. I don't know if he, you know, pulled a Chris Jericho on Kane backstage and just knocked coffee into somebody by accident and pissed them off it was the wrong person. I don't know what the hell happened here. I know it's only 1 week, but that's not how you book a big guy when, you know, you're doing the proverbial bodyguard storyline, or really any guy, you know, any big guy like that that you're trying to put over. You know, all it takes is 1 week, like what we saw Monday night, to kill a guy dead. Why would you do that? Something must have happened. I have no idea. I haven't heard any stories. As far as I know, he didn't fail any tests. He's not about to be cut, but maybe they just had a change of heart. All I know is that if they have big things planned for this guy, what happened on Monday night does not make any sense. It just does not make any sense at all. Randy Orton and Sheamus, they had a pretty good match. I was very impressed when I saw Sheamus do the move where he launched himself, the launching shoulder block, a la Jim the Anvil Neidhart, who used to do that move. And I think Animal, actually, from the Road Warriors used to do that as well. But that was the first time I saw Sheamus pull off that move. He executed it successfully earlier in the match, and later on we would find out why. It was very smart to do that because it made sense. When he tried to go to the well again at the end of the match, here's a move. It's not like, you know, if Sheamus had not done that move earlier in the match, to me it would have made less sense, because why all of a sudden is Sheamus out on the apron trying this ridiculous move that I've never seen him do before, unless they were setting up this fake wrestling finisher, you know what I mean? And the fact that he actually did it earlier in the match and felt like he was going to go back to the well once again to try it again, I like that. That was a nice touch. You know, it's a story of him going to the well one too many times, and this time he paid the price for it. And it made for a pretty cool finish. Orton beat him clean, which tells me that, you know, they're still expecting Orton to be the guy challenging for the title. And as far as this whole Miz Morrison thing is concerned, they set up the Miz Morrison championship match for Raw this coming Monday night. Which, when I heard that, made me go, I wonder if they're setting up for a three-way at the Royal Rumble. I still believe that that's the direction they're going in. I guess it depends what happens on Monday night. I could be completely wrong. Maybe they hot-shot the title onto Morrison. Maybe Morrison's going to get the same treatment that Edge got in 2006 when he first won the title from Cena. And Edge won the belt. That was the first time he won the WWE title. Ratings went up. Interest in the product seemed to increase. And a lot of people felt, myself included, that, hey, don't take the title off this guy. It's working. It's fresh. It's cool. It's different. He should go to WrestleMania, and then he could drop the belt back to Cena. But no. 3 weeks later at the Royal Rumble, there was Edge in the middle of the ring at the Rumble, tapping to a really ugly-looking finisher. And just like that, dropped the belt back to Cena because they didn't want to change from their plans, which was John Cena and Triple H in the WrestleMania main event. So maybe we're looking at a similar situation. Maybe they're going to take the title off Miz, put it on Morrison, and in 3 weeks he'll drop the belt back to Miz at the Rumble. I don't like that idea. I think if you're going to put the belt on Morrison, first of all, it shouldn't be on fucking Monday Night Raw. You know, it should be at a pay-per-view, it should be a bigger deal, and it should come at a time when you have enough faith to keep the belt on him for more than 3 weeks. You don't need to keep playing hot potato with the belt. Let The Miz have himself a nice reign. Miz should not drop the belt before WrestleMania. And if John Cena versus The Miz, for example, is the match you want at WrestleMania, then build for it. Don't take the title off the guy now. See, my guess is that Miz somehow, he'll keep the belt on Monday, and, you know, I guess they could just do another straight match with Miz and Orton at the Rumble, but maybe they're setting up for a triple threat match. To me, though, that just doesn't show any balls. You know, if they really had balls, then they'd have Miz vs. Morrison one-on-one at the pay-per-view. You know, the Royal Rumble pay-per-view is going to be bought and sold based on the strength of the Rumble match. I think I talked about this last week. You've had Rumble pay-per-views before with really shitty title matches. I don't look at Miz vs. Morrison, quite frankly, as a shitty title match. I think it's actually got a nice ring to it. You know, why waste it next week? And why does it have to be a stipulation match? You know, when I saw Morrison come in for that backstage segment talking to Alex Riley and The Miz, and he said, you know, I'm facing Alex Riley tonight, and if I beat you, I get to pick the stipulation for the match. Wait a minute. Hold on a second. Stipulation? This is the first match. Why does there have to be a stipulation? Who made that declaration? I mean, Falls Count Anywhere will probably make it a more exciting match, but I don't know why. My first thought was, wait a minute, why does it have to have a stipulation? Why do we have to have pay-per-views that have the name of a stipulation? We just had a TLC pay-per-view. We now have a Money in the Bank pay-per-view. Fatal Four Way is an actual pay-per-view name. Some cracked-out drug addict actually came up with that name. They thought that Fatal Four Way would be a really good name for a pay-per-view. Amazing. So that was Raw Monday night. I didn't see SmackDown this week, and I didn't see Impact, although the final episode of TNA Reaction, which was in fact canceled because it was just too cost prohibitive for Spike TV, the final reaction aired on Thursday night. So if you were a fan of the show, I was a fan of the concept. I can't say I watched it every single week. But I like the concept, and when I did see Reaction, I usually enjoyed what I saw. So it really is a shame that one of the few things about TNA that I thought was actually really good is the thing that got sacrificed. And I can't blame TNA; it was a Spike TV decision. But yeah, that was the swan song for TNA Reaction. So if you are a fan of that show, you are in mourning right now. But you can cut that period of mourning short, because what I'm going to do right now, it's about that time to get to the Solid Monsters Best of WWE 2010 Countdown. Now, like I said, it could be a combination of different things. It could be an angle. It could be somebody made a return. It could be a match. For all the crap that we see in wrestling these days, and specifically in WWE, because for all the railing I do on TNA, it's not like WWE is immune to criticism either. In fact, they probably bear more criticism on this podcast than TNA does just by virtue of me talking about them more. But for all the bullshit and all the crap that we've seen over the course of 2010, was 2010 really all that bad of a year for WWE? At the end of the day, 2010 was a mixed bag for WWE. It was a year that saw a business which was still very good. And believe me, it's a company that is not in jeopardy of going bankrupt anytime soon. But it was a year that did see business continue to fall in terms of TV ratings, in terms of pay-per-view buy rates, in terms of the number of tickets sold to live events. There was a lot of veteran talent that was either out with injuries, you know, Triple H being chief among them, Christian, who I know is not exactly a main eventer in WWE, but still, he was having nothing but great matches on SmackDown, and then he tore his pec. In other cases, you had top stars, even more than injuries, they just decided to leave the company. Shawn Michaels retired, Batista quit, well, actually he didn't quit, he quit in storyline, but his contract expired and he chose not to renew it. Chris Jericho left again for how long, we don't know. It could be a while before Jericho decides to come back, if he decides to come back. On the other hand, what stuff like that does is it forces the company to push younger guys. Nexus, obviously, was probably the best example of that. You can talk about how they kind of fucked it up at the end, but the fact is, you took these six, seven, or eight, however many people it was initially, unknowns, relative unknowns, who were on NXT, a show for the rookies, quote-unquote, and they became main eventers. Now, they weren't all ready for the main event. Michael Tarver was not ready for the main event. I would argue David Otunga is not ready for the main event. Heath Slater, while he is good, is not ready for the main event. But they were given a chance. And a lot of other guys, too. You know, Sheamus really came into his own in 2010. He truly did become a main eventer this year. John Morrison has been getting more of a push of late. Daniel Bryan has been having nothing but great matches. He's the U.S. champion. He's on a bit of a winning streak. Alberto Del Rio has had a lot of success on SmackDown. And he's also benefited because SmackDown, the roster there, is just so thin right now. And then you have somebody like The Miz, who 2010 was truly his breakout year. He should have been, as I said, for the Slammy Awards, Superstar of the Year. So it wasn't just a cut-and-dry good year or a cut-and-dry bad year. It was a mixed bag. It was a lot of good to look at. So what I'm going to do here, I'm just going to run through a top 10 list. It's nothing overly complicated, and it's certainly a very subjective list. I'm sure everybody listening would have their own list if you took 5 minutes to jot down the top 10 from 2010. You can feel free to email me, and I'll maybe get to some of those responses next week. We'll just do this in rank order, starting from the bottom, working our way up to the top. So number 10 on my list, again, the best of WWE 2010, I have NXT. Now, you might say, holy shit, Solomonster, how do you put NXT on that list after all the times you crapped on it? Well, allow me to explain here. NXT Season 3 was an abomination. NXT Season 4 so far hasn't been all that far behind. NXT Season 2 was better than Season 3, but it was still mostly crap. Which brings me to Season 1. This was the very first year for the NXT concept. The NXT concept was born earlier this year, in 2010. Now, when it was first announced, I was actually very excited about it because, as it was explained to me, this was going to be very similar to the old Tough Enough show. And I was a big fan of Tough Enough. Tough Enough, if you go back and watch it now, all these years later, probably looks even better because it's just so different than anything WWE is doing that you can watch Tough Enough from the year 2000 or 2001 and appreciate it for how real and gritty it felt. So that's what I was under the impression NXT was going to be like. Not exactly. It's not like you were going to have these guys living in a house and it was going to be an MTV reality show. But we'd have in-depth video pieces showing them on the road training, what it's like to have to travel and be in airports and rent a cars and learn from the pros who would come in and give a pep talk or a speech. And it was going to be made to feel quote-unquote real. And obviously what NXT turned out to be was something far different. Now, it's not a complete fail of a concept. The concept of having a, quote, pro mentor a rookie is not a bad idea in theory. What made this idea not so good, in my opinion, was NXT just became another WWE show, which is exactly what it did not need to be. And putting these guys out there in front of actual, live, full WWE crowds was the wrong move. You know, these guys should not be wrestling in front of these crowds, especially because these crowds could not give a crap about any of these guys, because they didn't know who anybody was. And they would tape it before SmackDown, and the people were there to see SmackDown. They weren't there to see, you know, Florida Championship Wrestling on parade. So, in execution, NXT could have been so much better than it was. But the fact is, you and I can't deny that, at least in terms of Season 1 of NXT, a lot of good came out of that. For example, Daniel Bryan. Would I have handled Daniel Bryan the same way they handled him at the beginning? Absolutely not. I do look back fondly. One of the best moments of 2010 was that one episode where he just beat the shit out of Michael Cole. That was great. I think the interplay between him and Michael Cole has been mostly entertaining. And to me, it was just good to finally see Bryan Danielson get a shot on WWE television after all these years. After all the years of being called the best in the world, at least on the independent circuit, now he's finally being given an opportunity in front of the world to prove that he truly is among the best when you really give him a chance. Wade Barrett is a guy that I would not have known from any Joe Schmo on the street, except that he has a British accent. But Wade Barrett, and by the way, this is the same Wade Barrett who was mentored by Chris Jericho on NXT and would come out wearing a cape. Thank God, as part of Nexus, wearing a cape is not part of the dress code, because he just looked ridiculous. He looked like Count Chocula. But Wade Barrett surprised me, because when he was essentially, you know, when Daniel Bryan especially was fired from the company, he became the de facto leader of Nexus. And I think Wade Barrett is the real shining star of that first season of NXT. He surprised me. He came out of nowhere. I was not familiar with him. I didn't know how good or how bad he was. In the ring, it's not like he's anything overly special. He's better than, you know, a David Otunga in that he's at least serviceable. He knows what he's doing in there, and I think he'll only get better. But as a promo guy, I mean, I would liken him to somebody like Byron Saxton from the current season of NXT, in that he already has main event level promo ability. And I'm just so used to hearing guys on the microphone who, quite frankly, suck that it's refreshing when I hear somebody on the microphone who doesn't stumble over their own words and actually knows what they're doing. So, Wade Barrett alone, him coming out of NXT as a big star and becoming a main eventer, is one of the big reasons that NXT is on my list of best things in WWE in 2010. Guys like Justin Gabriel and Heath Slater and Skip Sheffield until he got hurt. You know, and as far as Skip Sheffield is concerned, that was a real shame, because I thought Skip Sheffield was going to be one of the real breakout stars of that group. There was something about him that made me think of Batista in Evolution towards the end, when you knew that Batista at some point was going to kind of figure out that Triple H was just using him. And even though we all expected Randy Orton to come out of Evolution as the big star, people were really getting behind Batista. And Batista is the one who really got over and broke free and became a big monster star on his own. I don't know what it was. I know it's a completely different storyline, but there was something about Skip Sheffield that gave me the Batista in Evolution vibe, as I call it. And then he got hurt. He broke his ankle. I have no idea when he's going to be back. I think he's still, you know, probably 2 months or so away from being able to come back. I have no idea what they're going to do with him. I don't even know if Nexus will be around when he's ready to come back, but that's a shame, because I really did think that there was something big in store for Skip Sheffield. But like I said, Wade Barrett and even the other members of Nexus, who I'm not, you know, I don't like all of them, but it was something different, you know, when they came onto the scene. And it was the one big positive to come out of NXT, more than Season 2, more than Season 3, that's for shit sure. It has to be on this list, because it could have been better, but we got a lot of fresh, good talent out of it, at least that first season, and it cracks my list. Top 10, it's at number 10. Number 9 on my list is the Big Red Machine, Kane, getting one last run. I presume one last run. I could be wrong about that. But some may say his first real run with the World Heavyweight Championship. A lot of Kane fans out there. I don't need to give you a history lesson, but I will anyway. Kane, of course, has been in WWE forever. Forever being 1997. And Kane had a 24-hour reign as WWE champion in 1998, and in all the years that Kane has been in this company, in all the people he's feuded with, and all the pay-per-view matches and WrestleManias and everything that he's been in, and he's held intercontinental titles, hardcore titles, tag team titles, he's never held a world championship longer than a day since that one reign in 1998. Now, I always thought that was a crime, because in the late 90s and the early part of this you know, current, I guess, is this still the same decade, or would this now be considered a new decade? I don't even know. But Kane was one of the better big guys that I've ever seen in the ring. He was agile. He can jump over the top rope to the floor and go chasing after somebody. He could come off the top rope with that top rope clothesline, which he still does. Obviously, he's a little pudgier now and doesn't move around quite as well. Actually, he doesn't move around nearly as well as he used to do. But he's also 10-plus years older, and he's a big guy. And those big guys, 10 years later, you know, I'm sure their knees or their back or whatever are not going to be doing as well. But Kane always impressed me as a big guy. Kane, to me, will go down as one of the all-time great big men in the business. And it was a shame that he was never given another run with the title. He was the first superstar, at least in WWE history, to ever be world champion wearing a mask. He was the first masked superstar to ever be a world champion. And he should have had more than one run, or at least that one run should have been lengthier than it was. But Stone Cold was the big star at the time, and they wanted to put the belt back on him. It was nothing more than a ratings grab. Were it not for TV ratings, Kane probably wouldn't have even had that one title run. So fast forward to 2010, Kane, of all people, is in a Money in the Bank ladder match, and he wins. He actually wins the match, and people are cheering him. People are cheering him like it's 1998 all over again, because believe me, he had a lot of fans in 98 too. Go back and listen to the reaction at the King of the Ring when he won the belt. But Kane wins. He cashes in Money in the Bank later in the night against Rey Mysterio, and in a minute becomes World Heavyweight Champion. And it warmed my heart when that happened. Now, I know that Kane would go on to have a lot of really bad matches. You know, that's the one drawback here. You could probably pick out negative things about every one of the things on my top 10 list. For all the good in it, there's some bad. And when it comes to Kane, the bad thing is he had a lot of really piss-poor pay-per-view matches. I mean, those matches with The Undertaker, and it had a lot to do with Undertaker, because Undertaker's in rough shape. But those matches were just fucking atrocious. I mean, they were so bad. And his matches and this whole stupid storyline with Edge has been even worse. So Kane has not been lighting the world on fire as champion. But the fact that he got that one, presumably last run with the big belt, and it was longer than a day, in fact, he was champion for like 5 months, to me, I have to put that on here as a positive, because I really think the guy deserves it. For all the service he's given this company and how he got ripped off with that first title run, I, for one, was happy to see him get the belt. And, ironically, for very different reasons, I was actually happy to see him lose the belt when he did at the TLC pay-per-view. Number 8 on my countdown is Triple H goes missing. Triple H, in case you didn't notice, has missed the large majority of 2010. He was knocked out of commission by Sheamus during their feud back in April. And Triple H beat Sheamus at WrestleMania, got beaten by Sheamus in their, I think it was Extreme Rules in April, when Sheamus beat him, and then he followed up by, you know, putting him out of action, injuring him, beating the shit, if you will, out of Triple H. And Triple H has not been seen on TV since. Now, of course, the reason Triple H was knocked out of action, he had a nagging neck injury at the time, and I know one of his surgically repaired quad muscles was also giving him some issues. So he needed a little bit of time off, but I don't think he expected to be off the entire rest of 2010, because what ended up happening was he did film two movies in the interim for WWE Films. One's called The Chaperone, which I believe is coming out in a couple of months, and he filmed another one. Actually, that second movie might have been the one that Dave Bautista was originally pegged for before he told WWE that he wasn't going to re-sign, and they said, fuck you, we're going to replace you with Triple H. But anyway, so he filmed two movies, but what happened is he then, I think he tore his bicep. He suffered an arm injury, I guess while training or whatever. And that's also a very serious injury. So originally Triple H was due to be back around October, and then he got hurt and wasn't fully recovered. And he may already be at a point where he can come back, but, you know, WWE is not going to waste a Triple H return by having him come back at the very end of the year. They're going to wait until the beginning of next month, maybe closer to the Rumble. My guess would be that if Triple H is not back by the Royal Rumble, or I should say before the Rumble, then by the Rumble, he should definitely be back. And it would just make sense for him to resume his feud with Sheamus, wrap things up with him, presumably with a win, and then move on to somebody fresh. I think it was actually a very good thing. I don't wish injury upon anybody. I don't like that Triple H got hurt, and I'm not saying that that's why, you know, I put him on this list because it was a good thing he got hurt. It was a good thing that Triple H was away for a while, is what I'll say. Because if anybody was stale and overexposed, it was Triple H. And he's gone through periods like that over the years. I mean, I don't know that he's ever been more overexposed than he was back around, let's say, 2003, 2004. I don't think I've ever been more sick of a wrestler than I was of Triple H back during what I call his reign of terror on the Raw brand around 03 and 04. Actually, that whole 2002 to 2004 period. But even in 2010, he needed some time off. And in that time off that he had, in his absence, again, we saw the rise of a lot of younger guys that maybe we wouldn't have seen all of them get an opportunity if Triple H was taking up TV time. Maybe Sheamus, you know, wouldn't have gotten over as well as he did. Even though Triple H did play a big part in working with him at the beginning of the year, you know, guys like Miz, guys like Morrison, maybe it wouldn't have happened that way. Maybe. So, to me, Triple H being gone for most of 2010, that was a positive. I look at that as a positive. And hopefully he'll come back. I'm actually at a point now where he's been gone so long that I'm looking forward to a Triple H return. You know, that's kind of my point. The guy's been gone for so long, they say absence makes the heart grow fonder. Hulk Hogan knew that better than anybody else. That's why Hogan used to come back for a couple of months and then disappear. And then you wouldn't see him again for 6 months to a year. And then when he came back, people would go apeshit for the guy. Because he knew. So, Triple H makes my list number 8. Triple H gone, missing. One of the better things of 2010. Because he'll be that much fresher when he comes back. Number 7, CM Punk, the announcer. I, like many of you, took a lot of enjoyment out of CM Punk being on commentary. Unfortunately, it was short-lived. We all thought that Punk would probably be on commentary a little bit longer, being that he was still supposedly injured. But I guess he healed up quicker than people had thought. And so, can't cry for the guy. He's involved in a storyline with John Cena. He's the new leader of Nexus. I think CM Punk's going to be okay. But unfortunately, selfishly, I still wish he was able to do... maybe he could do both. Maybe he can wrestle and announce. Maybe he could do what Jerry Lawler used to do. He can wrestle with a microphone in his hand. But, you know, that's not likely to happen. So, in the time that he did announcing, I mean, we knew CM Punk had the gift of gab. He's always been a damn good promo. He's been one of the best promo guys in the entire company. We figured that out during his world championship runs as a heel and as the leader of the Straight Edge Society. But now Punk has a different faction to lead, and that's all well and good. But, like I said, selfishly, I got so used to him being on Raw. I'm not usually a fan of the three-man announce booths on Raw. But if you're going to have Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, at least having CM Punk there was an entertaining element. You know, sometimes he would try to keep the two of them at bay. He would crack jokes, sometimes inside jokes. You know, him sitting there with a sport coat over his Colt Cabana t-shirt, come on. There's nothing better than that in the world. You know, and Punk actually did an interview recently where he said that one of the things he realized in terms of doing this announcing is that he now has something he can do when he retires. And I hope CM Punk doesn't retire for a long time, but when he does, hopefully he'll still have his wits about him and he'll be able to be as good at the announce booth as he was the last... how long was he doing commentary for? Was it even a full 2 months? I don't even know if it was that long. So, sad to see him go, but it was one of the more unexpected treats of 2010, while it lasted, was CM Punk the announcer on Raw. Number 6, Daniel Bryan matches. That's how I have it listed here, quite frankly, because I'm a Daniel Bryan fan, and I've seen him wrestle in person. You know, when he was in Ring of Honor, and he was the Ring of Honor champion. In fact, there was one show, it was the very first Ring of Honor show I ever went to. It was at the New Yorker Hotel, which was the final show they were doing there, because this ballroom in the hotel could barely fit the people that were in there. And from that point on, after that, all the shows were, and still are, taking place from the nearby Manhattan Center, which is where Monday Night Raw used to be taped at the very beginning. It's literally right around the corner from the hotel. But at that hotel show, there was a triple threat main event between Bryan Danielson, Samoa Joe, and I forgot who the other person was. It was one of the Japanese stars, Kenta. I believe it was Kenta. And Danielson was known in those matches. We don't see him doing this in WWE, thank God, because they probably wouldn't let him. But he would do this dive where, in this case, his two opponents were outside the ring, and in fact, his two opponents were in the crowd. They were over the barrier, in the crowd, right where we were. And you could see Danielson in the ring, and what he would do is he would propel himself up to the top rope, and then he would do a dive into the crowd. It was usually a cannonball dive onto the wrestlers, into the crowd. And he did this right in front of me, to the point where he almost killed me. Bryan Danielson almost killed me. I wouldn't be sitting here doing this podcast right now if it wasn't for him. So depending on whether or not you like this show, you might want to thank him or not. But so I've seen him compete in person. And I don't remember seeing a bad Bryan Danielson match. His matches were always fun. The crowd would be into them. He had all these innovative moves. He doesn't look like much. You know, Michael Cole really isn't all that wrong when he says he looks like a dork and a nerd. Quite frankly, he does, but that's part of his charm. And he's just so goddamn good at what he does. It really shouldn't shock any of us, considering that Shawn Michaels and William Regal were his two trainers coming up in the business. And I'm happy that after that entire debacle with him earlier in the summer, and the outrage over him being fired for no good reason at all. I mean, people, you know, I still have not heard one good legitimate reason why he was let go in the first place. And there was a huge outcry, and they brought him back, and ever since that time, he's had nothing but good matches. He had good matches with Ted DiBiase. He had great matches with Dolph Ziggler a couple of months back. And the people really do get behind him. He plays a great babyface. As a heel, you know, he was a heel on the Independents, too. I mean, you know, I think he might have been, he was a heel in Ring of Honor. It's not like he's never been a heel before, but he just works so much better. Like, some people are just born to do things a certain way. You know, some wrestlers are born to be a heel. I always felt like Shawn Michaels, at least the first part of his career, was born to be a heel. You know what I mean? Jake Roberts, as great a babyface as he was, that guy was born to be a heel. The Million Dollar Man, that whole character, could not have been a babyface. I feel like Daniel Bryan was born to be a babyface. Just a purebred babyface that people can get behind. And he's had great matches. He's, like I said earlier, he's got a bit of a win streak going. He's the United States champion. I know that belt doesn't mean shit, but still. The fact that they put a title on you means they have some confidence in you. And I know he doesn't fit the mold as being the biggest guy in the world, but I still maintain that couple of years, as long as they don't fire him for doing, you know, some other stupid thing. He's a guy that could very well main event WrestleMania. He doesn't have to be 6'2" or 6'8". You know what I mean? I mean, he can go out there and steal the show. He can go out there, he could talk. You give him the opportunity to talk. The one thing about him that kind of annoys me, and I don't know if this is something that the company tells him to do or if he does it on his own, I will say that on occasion, when he's cutting a promo, he has a tendency to kind of smile, almost like giggle, which kind of annoys me. And if I'm going to call John Cena out on that stuff, I'll call Daniel Bryan out on it too. It doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, it's not a big deal now. If it happens more often, then, you know, that would make me angry. But Daniel Bryan matches are one of the shining spots of 2010 in WWE, because he's had some pretty damn good ones. Number 5 on the top 10 countdown here, Raw goes old school. This is definitely a personal choice. I don't know if everybody would agree with me on this, but one of my favorite, if not my favorite Raw show of the year was back on November 15th. They had the old school edition of Monday Night Raw. It was a 3-hour show, and for the first time, they went with this old school motif for the entire episode. Everything from the ring skirts, to the turnbuckle pads, to the banners in the arena, to the intro to the show, to the Raw set, to the interview platform in the back of the arena with Mean Gene Okerlund, all the legends they trotted out there, George the Animal Steel eating the turnbuckle pads, Piper's Pit. I mean, even the promotional consideration paid for by the following bit where they use Lord Alfred Hayes' voice, even though he's been dead for 5 years, I appreciated that. You know, as somebody who at a young age grew up on the syndicated programming on the weekends, WWF Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, you know, I grew up in the Northeast. I mean, I'm sure if I grew up in the South, I would have grown up on NWA wrestling, but I didn't. I grew up a WWF fan, and I grew up with all the wacky characters and, you know, Vince McMahon and Jesse the Body Ventura on commentary, or Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan. You know, God bless Gorilla, and God bless Bobby Heenan, quite frankly, who's still alive and kicking, but it's a shame that Gorilla isn't around and Bobby is in the state that he's in, because, you know, on a show like that, if we could have gotten the two of them back together to do just even one match or one skit, that would have just made my year. But as it is, I thought it was actually, you know, the show itself probably was just okay, but I really enjoyed the old school aspects of it, even just the red, white, and blue ring ropes. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't mean shit. There's far bigger problems to deal with, but I just love stuff like that. It just makes me feel like a kid all over again. You know what I mean? It just brings back memories. And just looking at the screen with all the different colors and the logos, and of course, for the one match, they brought Jim Ross back, which was a huge improvement. But it just brings me back to a better time in wrestling. And, you know, not just because I was younger, and so therefore it's all nostalgia, and that's why I look back on it that way. There are a lot of aspects in terms of how they did things on those shows back then that could easily be integrated into the show now. And it would make the product so much better. And the fact that, well, we have to keep reinventing ourselves. Well, that's true. I understand that. But at some point, you have to tell yourself, what's the point of reinventing yourself if you keep reinventing yourself into crap? I mean, think about it like that. You can change with the times, you can change the music for your show and the intro and the way that promos are cut, but if you're changing it for the worse, what good does that do? So it was almost kind of depressing when the show was over, because I was hoping that when I put my TV on the following Monday that we would still have a lot of that stuff on the screen, and obviously we didn't. They pretty much just went right back to the way things were. Which again was a shame, because there were certain elements that I think you could have started integrating into the show. But for one night, it made me feel like a kid again. It put a smile on my face. I enjoyed seeing most of the legends. You know, the Slickster coming out to Jive Soul Bro. You know, even though that whole character and all that stuff back in the 80s was just completely politically incorrect, I'm willing to look past that. It was a fun night for me as a wrestling fan. And like I said, it was probably my favorite Raw episode of 2010. Number four on my list is The Rise of The Miz, Mike Mizanin. Said it before, guy should have won Superstar of the Year at the Slammies. These stupid fans don't know what the hell they're talking about. You know, here's a guy who, he was on a reality show on MTV, and everybody knew he was a wrestling fan. He was so fucking obnoxious. He came up with this character called The Miz, and he just annoyed the fuck out of everybody. And who would have thunk that same kid would be standing here today as the WWE champion? I mean, I was one of those people when Miz and Morrison broke up. I figured Morrison was going to be the Michaels and Miz was going to be the Jannetty. And that's not to say that, you know, Miz didn't have the ability or the talent, but I just figured the company doesn't see in Miz what they see in Morrison. Morrison looks like a rock star. He's got a better body. He's more 10. And what we found out was that John Morrison is really, really good. Except on promos. I'm sorry, he just is not very good on promos, but he's really, really good. And I think Morrison is also going to be a world champion one day. But what we found out is Miz has more of the total package that they're looking for. On the microphone, he carries himself like a star. Morrison still seems like he's nervous about something, like he's not quite there yet. As a performer, Morrison probably is better than Miz. I will give him that. But as the complete package, you know, what WWE would like to see in one of their superstars, Miz has it all. And he did everything that he had to do to get himself over to that level. He used to wear these really ridiculous-looking pants, and he wore his hair in a really stupid way. He still got more or less the same haircut, which is fine. I just think he looks better now, but he changed his whole appearance. You know, the tights that he wore to the ring, he got new entrance music, He basically, in some respects, he reinvented himself because he realized that's what he had to do. I remember he did an interview after he started wearing the new ring gear. Because, again, he used to wear long pants, and now he wears tights. And Vince McMahon saw him backstage and said, "Hey, kid, I didn't realize you had such good legs." Which, in all honesty, if you tell that story to the average guy, he's going to think that's a pretty, homosexual comment. No offense. But for Vince McMahon to say that to one of his employees is actually taken as a good thing. And when he started doing that, that's when Vince and the people who worked in the company started seeing something in him. His in-ring work improved. He's not Lou Thesz in the ring, but he's better than he used to be. And again, on the mic and as a character, he came up with that "I'm awesome" catchphrase. He just completely made himself into a star. Earlier in the year, he was a unified tag team champion with the Big Show. He won the Money in the Bank briefcase. He was a United States champion for a long time. And he cashed in and beat Randy Orton and became WWE champion. And he did it all in one calendar year. Now, it's not the best year that a WWF guy has ever had. I still think that Kurt Angle or Brock Lesnar, I think Kurt Angle takes the cake as far as, somebody coming onto the scene and having the single best year that anybody's ever had. But The Miz is not that far behind. He had one hell of a 2010, and WWE made itself a star. Congratulations. Now the key is to not kill the guy dead, which is kind of what I was talking about earlier. I think if you take the belt off him on Raw this coming Monday, you're not doing him any favors. Let the guy have a run until WrestleMania with the belt. There's no harm in that. But The Miz has been one of the shining spots of 2010 in WWE, and he is at number 4 on my top 10 countdown. Number 3 is the Nexus debut, an attack on John Cena back in June. I still remember that angle. It was a 3-hour Raw. I missed the first, 2.5 hours of Raw. I was not home, and I kept checking in on my BlackBerry to see what was going on. And I read the results of the show, and I read the stupid skits and everything, and I thought to myself, I don't miss not seeing the show at all. This show sounds fucking atrocious. And then I came home, and I saw the final match. The fans voted CM Punk to be John Cena's opponent, and they had a match. And in the middle of the match, there's Wade Barrett, and all the guys from NXT Season 1 come out of the crowd, and they proceed to just absolutely beat the shit out of John Cena. They beat the shit out of Jerry Lawler. They beat the shit out of Justin Roberts and Mark Eaton, the poor ringside guy that we always see out there. He was the guy that got super kicked by Shawn Michaels during the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. There's a little trivia note for you. For the first time in my entire memory, I could think, we saw the WWE ring exposed. I mean, these guys were just literally tearing shit up all over the place at ringside. They were throwing furniture around. They were ripping up the mats on the floor. They ripped up the canvas. We saw the wooden panels underneath. This was a jarring angle, and the crowd didn't know what to make of it. It was very NWO-like in its execution. People actually in the crowd thought it was real. There were people crying and getting very panicked and worried and excited. And I think I may have said this at the time, but the more I think about it, I kind of wonder if the rest of that 3-hour show was made to look bad on purpose. I mean, that was a bad show. I mean, go back and find the results of that episode of Raw and the skits and everything. It was a bad show. But maybe it was that way on purpose, because then all of a sudden you come out with this really serious angle, and it's just that much more effective. And that's what this angle was. It was very effective, and it got people talking. Now, we all know what ended up happening. I mean, Nexus should not have lost that main event match, that 7-on-7 at SummerSlam. I still maintain they should not have lost. But for that one night, Nexus was the thing in wrestling. People were talking about that for a long time after that. And that will go down to me as one of the all-time great Raw angles. That one night. Forget the follow-up and everything else. That one night, it will go down all-time on Raw. And for 2010, it may well have been the best angle of the year on Monday Night Raw. Number 2 on my top 10 countdown is Undertaker retiring Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 26. And this is one of those things that it can be on your best-of list and it can be on your worst-of list. Obviously, it was bad because we saw the retirement of Shawn Michaels. And Shawn Michaels has been an anchor in the company and an anchor on the Raw brand now for so many years that people, myself included, were genuinely concerned about what happens when that day comes that Shawn Michaels either gets hurt and he's done, or he decides to just say, I'm done, I'm retiring. And I always worried about that, you know, because part of it is, excuse me, I grew up, again, I saw Shawn Michaels when he was with the Rockers. I saw him when he became a single star. He was a heel. He was the Intercontinental Champion. Then he became a babyface, and he got beat up in Syracuse, and he became the champion for the first time, and then DX was formed. So I followed this guy's career in the WWE from the beginning right up until now. And I almost felt like when Shawn Michaels goes, maybe it's time for me to go, because there aren't that many guys left after him from those, you know, days gone by. And part of me almost feels out of touch with what's going on. So, you know, we all knew the day would come, and Shawn and Undertaker had a phenomenal match at WrestleMania. I still prefer their WrestleMania 25 match. I still think that was just, from a match perspective and from, you know, an emotion perspective, I mean, I guess the emotion was greater here because the man's career was on the line. It was streak versus career, whereas the year before it was really just about the streak. But, so even though I prefer that WrestleMania 25 match, WrestleMania 26 was still a phenomenal match. And I won't soon forget the ending to that match. You know, Shawn slapping The Undertaker, Undertaker picking him up and giving him a jumping tombstone pile driver, which I'm sure did not do Undertaker's creaky knees any favors, but that was a hell of a finish. And the two men embrace after the match, and the, you know, they turn the music off, and they just pan out to show, you know, 60,000 plus in Phoenix, Arizona, on their feet, cheering for Shawn Michaels as he makes that long walk down the aisleway. And really, the only thing missing from that match was Jim Ross on commentary. And that's, I'm not going to get into that. It was a whole thing. Jim Ross was actually in the building that night. He was all the way up in one of the suites. And he wanted badly to be there calling that match. And there were people, including Shawn and Undertaker, who lobbied Vince McMahon, which is not unlike what happened at WrestleMania 15 and 99. Remember, Michael Cole was doing commentary with Jerry Lawler then, too, because Jim Ross had been out after suffering his second bout of Bell's palsy. And Steve Austin and The Rock went to Vince McMahon, and they lobbied for Jim Ross to come out and call that main event match. So Michael Cole actually got up and had to walk to the back and relinquish his spot so Jim Ross could come out and call the match. And unfortunately, the same did not happen in 2010. You know, Michael Cole is he's the guy now, and so it wasn't the same without Jim Ross. I thought Michael Cole did fine, but, you know, Jim Ross, he called most of the big matches that Undertaker and Shawn Michaels had in their career, and if it was going to be Shawn's last match, I just think it would have been appropriate, even make it a three-man booth. I'm not saying Michael Cole shouldn't have been there, but JR should have been there too. But even so, it was a great match. Michaels did not have the big pomp and circumstance the next night on Raw that Ric Flair had. He came out in his cowboy hat. He cut, you know, a very, you know, emotional, sweet promo, I guess you would say. He was being very open and honest, and he thanked a lot of people, and then he walked off, and that was it. And the only time we've seen him on TV since then has been in that taped speech when he accepted his Slammy Award. And, like I said, very sad to see Shawn Michaels go, but still, the way that whole storyline was handled, the match he had with Undertaker, being able to come out the next night, talk to the people, and go out on his own terms, will go down as one of the great moments of 2010. And it was just something really special, I think, if you were a fan of Shawn Michaels. And the number one moment, the number one item, the number one thing on the Solid Monsters Best of WWE in 2010 list. And I know some people, like I said, will have their own opinions on what should be number one and what should be on the list and not on the list. But to me, as a fan, seeing Bret the Hitman Hart back inside a WWE ring, especially after all those years when he said he was never going to do it, and you see 12 years go by and you figure, the guy was probably telling the truth when he said that. Or at least he believed that at the time. But I certainly reached that point in the last few years where I realized, okay, this guy's not coming back. I mean, even when Shawn Michaels did that tease on Raw back in 05, when he was feuding with Hulk Hogan, he was in Canada, he said, you know, he was talking trash about Bret Hart, and then Bret's music hit, and the place went bonkers. And I thought for sure, he's coming out, and he didn't. They even fooled me. And maybe that was the point that I realized. If he didn't come back now, if he didn't come back in 2006 when WWE tried to get him and Vince McMahon thought he had him, you know, because we had the big Shawn Vince storyline and they had their WrestleMania match and WWE wanted Bret to be there. They wanted Bret to either referee the match or come out and interfere. And the whole thing the next month where Shawn Michaels ended up teaming with God against Vince and Shane, you know, when that idea was originally conceived, it wasn't meant to be God. You know, essentially it was a handicap match. That was supposed to be the spot where Bret Hart would actually team with Shawn Michaels. They thought they had him, and they didn't get him. And I figured, man, if they didn't get him then, they're never going to get him. And then I started hearing rumblings at the very end of 2009 that Bret Hart and Vince McMahon and WWE were close to terms on an agreement for him to come back. And not only come back like a one-time appearance, but come back as part of a storyline. And I was a bit befuddled by this, but excited. But it was one of those, well, I'll believe it when I see it. And I think it was Dennis Miller who did that awful job of hosting the Slammy Awards on Raw last year. And at some point during his shtick that night, he name-dropped Bret Hart. And I thought to myself, wow, maybe this is really going to happen. And then, of course, Vince mentioned Bret Hart and said, Bret will never be back here. He'll never guest host. And Shawn came out and convinced Vince to change his mind. And Bret Hart was announced as being a Raw guest host on January 4th. It was the big head-to-head WWE versus TNA battle. You had Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff coming back on Spike TV. And on the opposite channel, here was Bret the Hitman Hart in the flesh in Ohio. Should have been Canada, but whatever. It was Ohio. Coming out, first time in 12 years in a WWE arena. And with his new remix theme music, which I didn't like when I first heard it that night. I thought they should have used his original music, but the new music has actually grown on me to the point where I almost prefer it. But there he was. He looks older. Looks like he had a stroke. You can't deny that, but for a guy that did have as serious a stroke as he had, he has made a remarkable recovery. But look, anybody's going to look older and more beaten up 12 years later. And, you know, he calls out Shawn Michaels and makes peace with him, and he calls out Vince McMahon, and it leads to a feud. It leads to a WrestleMania match that I think a lot of us would rather forget. But for Bret, it was special. I mean, did Bret Hart really ever think he was going to wrestle at WrestleMania again? And, I mean, there he is, WrestleMania 26, his family surrounding the ring, beating the shit out of Vince McMahon with a chair in front of 65,000 people. Not the worst night in the world. And I, like a lot of people, figured that was probably going to be it. You know, when he originally signed, it was a short-term 3-month deal that was going to take him through the first 2 weeks after WrestleMania. And I guess, you know, they enjoyed working with each other, and Bret started showing up more often. And then he was at Raw in Toronto in May. And all of a sudden, Bret Hart is wrestling The Miz for the United States Championship. And Bret Hart beats The Miz, and he wins the U.S. title. So it's one thing if you would have told me a year ago that Bret Hart's coming back to WWE, because I probably would have laughed in your face, but to tell me that Bret was going to come back and wrestle and win a belt, I would have told you to have your head examined, but it happened. And again, Bret he wrestled in trios matches with the Hart Dynasty. They had a Bret Hart tribute night at Madison Square Garden in September where they honored him and he wrestled. He was actually in the main event of SummerSlam. Who would have thought Bret Hart would ever be in a main event at SummerSlam again? To me, it really made me feel good to see Bret Hart back. You may call him a hypocrite, you know, some people will, and you know, to some degree he is, but it's not something I fault him for. And I'm actually happy that the guy found peace and he put this shit to bed, because he will go down as one of the all-time great stars in the wrestling business. And he had a career that was based on great matches, and I mean, really, that's really what became his signature. You know, Bret Hart could have a match where you really honestly believe that this poor bastard was getting the shit kicked out of him from pillar to post. You know, he sold like $1 million, and he would have his comeback, and it was, you know, everybody's got their same 4 or 5 moves that they have. You know, John Cena and Triple H, they're no different. You know, Bret would have the side Russian leg sweep and the elbow smash off the second rope and the side backbreaker and the sharpshooter and all that. But there was nobody better at his craft than Bret Hart. And Bret Hart had some amazing matches over his career. And it's a shame that Goldberg mule kicked him in the head, and that we were deprived of you know, Bret Hart versus Kurt Angle, or Bret Hart versus, you know, John Cena, or Randy Orton, or more matches between Bret Hart and Steve Austin, or Bret Hart and Ric Flair, whatever the case may be. Seeing Bret Hart back in WWE in 2010 is not something that too many people thought they would see. And it's still somewhat surreal for me to think back that all of that actually happened, that he came back and he wrestled and he won a title and he main evented a pay-per-view. And it's really pretty amazing stuff. And I, for one, will look back at 2010, and to me, more so than the Nexus, and more so than, maybe even more so than Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania, since we already had seen that the year before. The first thing that's going to jump out in my mind is, that was the year Bret Hart came back. When you look back at 2010, what is the first thing that you think of? That should be one of the criteria that you judge when you're putting together your own top 10 countdown. And I don't know about you, but for my list, that's the number one thing that jumps out at me, and that's why it's in the number one spot. So there you go. That's my top 10 countdown, best of WWE 2010. I do have some quick honorable mentions here. Big gay Dave Bautista has to be on my list. I love the guy. You know, when he came out and did that promo on Cena leading up to their WrestleMania match where he said that he hates babies and fat girls or whatever it was, that was one of the great moments of the year. The debut of Alberto Del Rio, I think, is also a big plus that's going to reap bigger rewards for the company going forward. They've got big plans for him, and he got over a lot quicker and a lot better than I think a lot of people thought he would. You know, he was a star from Mexico who came over and used to wear a mask, and there was, you know, something of a controversy when they told him to ditch the mask, and that they had this character for him. And some people down in developmental said he had a big head. He had a big ego. He wasn't going to make it very far. He rubbed some people the wrong way when he first made his debut backstage. All the signs were there. But the guy took off, and he's one of the big stars on the SmackDown brand. It would not have surprised me at all if they would have put the belt on him at the TLC pay-per-view. And I think in 2011, he will have gold around his waist. World Championship gold. A lot sooner than some people may think. It was the year that Matt Hardy got his release, which was just, it was the best for all parties involved. Matt wanted to get out of WWE. WWE, I'm sure, even though they waited, they did not give him his release right away, but I'm sure they couldn't wait to get him out of their hair. And, I think it's almost a foregone conclusion where Matt is going, probably in just a couple of weeks. I hope he finds lots of luck and lots of success there. I've said my piece about Matt Hardy already. I've kind of poked fun at the guy and all that. He's got a lot of talent. I don't know that I could say the same for Brains. He seems like a smart guy, but you would never know it based on how he acts. But nonetheless, Matt was with WWE for a long time, and except that one hiccup in 2004, 2005, when he got fired, and he was gone for several months, he did come back. He was with the company for the most part, going all the way back to the mid-90s. I mean, 97 is when they really started to become major players, but Matt and Jeff, when they were young kids in their late teens, were doing jobs on Superstars in 1995 for Mantar and Razor Ramon. I mean, these are guys that grew up wrestling fans. They've been with the company for a long time. Matt was always there through thick and thin, even when his brother wasn't. And, you know, him getting his release was a big story. And like I said, hopefully it works out for both parties involved. And just one last quick thing here. I know there's other things I'm forgetting, but there was one reader, I think it was Mark, who wrote in and wanted me to make sure that I mention this, and I'll mention it just because I happen to agree with him. Of all the stupid, silly skits they do on Raw, which are mostly bad, there was one in particular a couple months back when they had Raw in the UK that was actually really funny and really entertaining, and I'll mention it here. Tea Time with Santino. When Santino was there with Kozlov and Sheamus, and he was serving him tea and cracking jokes about how pale he was, and Sheamus seemingly was doing everything in his power not to bust a gut laughing. I thought that was really entertaining. So, yeah, Tea Time with Santino gets an honorable mention as well. So there you go. The best of World Wrestling Entertainment 2010. Like I said, if you've got thoughts on your own list or something I may have missed, maybe I'll mention it in the feedback next week since I don't have time for it this week. Email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That's all one word, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, of course, twitter.com/solomonster, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/ The Solomonster. Got a lot of cool stuff up there, too, so you'll want to friend me in order to check that out. As always, you can subscribe to this very podcast on iTunes. In 2011, it's no different. You go to iTunes, you subscribe, it's free, it doesn't cost you anything. Every time an episode goes up, it will automatically download for you, so you are guaranteed to never miss an episode of The Sound Off. And really, why would you want to? So, with all that said, let me just say one quick thing here at the end of the show. I really enjoy doing this show. I think I've made that very clear in the past. It's something I do. I don't get paid for it or anything like that. I just really enjoy doing it. I'm a wrestling fan, and you're a wrestling fan, and we like to talk about wrestling, so what the hell? And it's built up a nice following for itself. 2010 was our best year yet. We picked up a lot of new listeners. I think this was the year that the Facebook page went active and all that, which that's been a great thing. We're at 530-something friends and growing. Hopefully you'll join our little community there. It's been a great year, and I'm positive that 2011 is going to be even better. And hopefully in terms of wrestling, WWE, TNA, ROH, hopefully things will turn a corner and get better, because I think we'd all agree that wrestling, for all the good and all the bad, it's still pretty much in a rut right now. And we're all waiting for that next big boom, and when there is a big boom, we all benefit from it. The fans like wrestling more. I have more to talk about. I like wrestling more. So hopefully all good things for 2011. And as always, thank you very much for supporting The Sound Off. Spread the good word and keep supporting SEScoops.com as well. So until next week, episode 141, this is the Solomonster wishing you and all of yours a very happy and healthy new year once again. We will see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys. Welcome to the first Sound Off of 2010. This is episode 95. Episode 100, episode 108, 115, 122, 127, 133, 139. Can't stand at the impact zone. They gotta get the fuck out of that building as quickly as possible. Get over yourself.
Get over yourself.
If Shane Helms wants to go off on somebody for being a drug user, I mean, that's in a way like, you know, the pot calling the kettle black here. If you really want to open up that can of worms, let's do that.
I don't necessarily love the fact that he came out dressed as a long-lost member of the Village People, but, you know, to each their own. I mean, in all honesty, if you ran into Big Dave in a dark alley and he was wearing what he was wearing on Monday night, would you really say something to him? I don't think so. You can resurrect some of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Andre the Giant can rise from the grave. It would not mean a damn thing.
The new owner of ECW, Stephanie McMahon. Angle, in the garbage. Done. Finished. I am not a fan of this angle. This is stupid. This is just stupid, unrealistic bullshit that we've seen so many times before. Who the fuck comes up with these names on NXT? Can you picture Husky Harris wrestling in the main event of WrestleMania? Percy Watson? Eli Cottonwood? And I gotta tell you something, there's no way that Paul Heyman watches that show on Thursday night and thinks, man, I gotta be a part of that. Abyss.
Abyss.
Why? Why?
Why?
I don't know.
Too bad you weren't near me. I'd eat your brains right now.
You're not that far away from me. I'm in Brooklyn, you're in Staten Island, so.
Maybe tickle your balls with a feather.
Due to a combination of steroids and pain pills, I have officially become a professional wrestler. Woo, woo, woo. You know it.